We the People.
We the People.
We the People of the United States.
We the People of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
In the summer of 1787, 55 men would gather in Philadelphia. They were tasked with fixing the government of the United States of America. Over the course of 4 months, they would debate, argue, refine and prepare the first document of its kind in the history of mankind, an attempt to prove that men can rule themselves by law. Over the next 3 years, the 13 United States would debate the ratification. This is the story of those men and of those times. It is a look at the ideas, the concepts, the debates, and the history of the Constitution of the United States. This is Constitution Thursday.
The convention begins to consider the Rutledge draft. The first element discussed is the number of representatives in the House. The proposed is one representative for every 40,000 inhabitants. A motion is made to change this to meet the 3/5 compromise standard. Rufus, King of Massachusetts, objects. The South can have its 3/5 or it can have the other things it wants. But not both. Gouverneur Morris rises to issue the first ever moral condemnation of slavery heard in a speech on American soil. When it's over, the convention rejects his plea, moves into committees, and begins the final work on the Constitution.
Some years ago, I was approached by some representatives of an organization who wanted me to, in my capacity as a chat show host at the time, speak out in favor of their particular issue. They'd had a website created and t-shirts printed up, and it was an intriguing idea at the time. The t-shirt, of course, immediately appealed to me because it had a picture of the man that I consider to be my favorite framer, my favorite founding father, my favorite president, General Washington, upon it. And it led to the idea, or it was promoting the idea, that General Washington had favored in the early days of the Republic, that representation in the House of Representatives be set at a ratio of one representative for every 30,000 inhabitants as defined by the Constitution, which at the time would have been citizens plus 3/5 of slaves. It's an intriguing idea, and the arguments for it today are, in my view, somewhat persuasive. The primary argument is that the framers, according to this particular group, which has a website, by the way, you can look this up yourself. I believe it's 30,000.org. According to them, the framers didn't foresee or never intended, and that's a dangerous phrase, but never intended the Congress representation to be more than 60 to 70,000 per representative. That is arguable, but in any case, the idea was equal representation, so that you break it down into the smallest chunks available, so that equal representation is provided for citizens. Today, of course, the figure sits at somewhere between 636,000 and 700,000, depending on what state you're in and the likes of that. And what this ends up doing, because the number of representatives has been capped at 435, it ends up with a convoluted, strange formula that you should look up for yourself. I mean, it's just an amazing formula that we use every 10 years to decide how many representatives each state gets. And in the process of this, what you end up with is unequal representation. For example, you take a district here in, say, California, where, take the 10th district, where you have roughly 670,000 people. And then we get one representative for this relatively small area. Then you go to some place like, well, I don't know, Wyoming, where the entire population of the state isn't all that high, or Montana or Delaware, or some of these places where the entire state area is represented. You end up with this inequity in representation. And moreover, what you end up with is an imbalance in the area. So here in California, for example, because the cities, the big cities, Los Angeles, San Diego, Sacramento, San Francisco, have larger populations, they naturally get more representation. Now, keep in mind that the Supreme Court is going to hear next year a case which could alter that. And in fact, goes back to the way I think that the framers really intended it to be, if I can use that word intended, because we don't really know. But it certainly fits more with what they had in mind. The problem, of course, is that if you take this, and this is the question that I had for this organization. I mean, if you think about this, 1 to 30,000, Congress is going to be huge. And I recall talking about this on the air. I said it at the time that, hey, why is that a problem? I mean, this is the United States of America. We can build a new building. We can add on as we need to. We could build a multi-purpose stadium kind of thing. But eventually you get to the point where Congress becomes unwieldy and it becomes too big, really, to do anything worthwhile. In fact, you could argue to some degree that it's already there at 435 in the House of Representatives. So you have this dichotomy here of this large group trying to accomplish something, and let's just say that we go with, for example, let's just say we go with the original, at least as far as the 30,000.org people say, the original was 70,000, okay? The upper end of that. That's what they believe was the upper limit. If you had a house that size based on the total population of the United States, now, of course, it wouldn't work out exactly that way because of the way the formula works out, but you would have a House of Representatives with 5,000 Congress people in it today. If you went to the 30,000 that they're advocating, you would have 11,667 people in Congress today. And if you went with the 40,000 that Rutledge originally put in the first draft of the Constitution, you would have a Congress of 8,750 congressmen. There's no way that a House that size gets anything done. I mean, criminy, how long would it take to vote for Speaker? Can you imagine that? Remember how we all watched the last election for Speaker? We sat there and we watched it. And what did that take? 2 hours for 435 people? Can you imagine what it would take for 11,667 congressmen to vote on Speaker of the House? No, what they would do is they would have to do this. And this is what the convention actually realizes as they come back from the break and they take up Rutledge's draft and they begin to digest it. They begin to look at it. Of course, the Massachusetts people and the Maryland people are just, Maryland especially, is just apoplectic about this. But as they begin to look at it and they really begin to talk about, okay, let's talk about this section here. And as they really begin to read it, there's some real oddities in what Rutledge has done. And there's some real things here that are going to cause a lot of friction. I would submit to you, and this is kind of opinion, so take it for what it's worth. If you're looking for the root cause of the American Civil War, and that's one of those games that historians play, is what really caused the American Civil War? If you're looking for the real root cause, look no further than Rutledge's first draft of the Constitution. I'll explain why here in just a minute. But as they're looking at all of this, they realize that, okay, we can debate sections of this, we can talk about parts of this, but like any large unwieldy body, I mean, they got 55 guys, not all of whom are there every day. In fact, attendance is actually averaging down around somewhere in the 30s, if that, on any given day. There's never a day when all 55 are there. Never. Even that group is too big to get stuff done. And they're starting to realize that they've been here so long and they've made no progress. And all of a sudden, here's this draft. And we may not like it, but there's progress being made. You know what? It's like the light bulb goes on. The collective light bulb fires up, and they realize, you know how we get this done? We have committees to do everything. And they start forming committees. They form committees on this section and committees on that section and committees to handle this. There's even a committee on, quote, postponed items, unquote. I call it the committee on everything else. It's the committee that's basic job is to just, you know, collect everything else that we've forgotten or didn't have time for, and we'll work on that. These committees are very political. They are politically charged, and based on what their area of expertise is, kind of determines who gets on those committees. But there's one guy who gets on no committees, and that, of course, is Luther Martin. Luther Martin is despised by basically everybody there. They all recognize him as a pretty smart guy and a good lawyer, but they also recognize the fact that he's annoying, he's bloviating, he's just a horrible orator. He's a terrible speaker. You would rather go to the dentist or chew tinfoil than listen to this guy speak. And to top it all off, he's usually drunk, or allegedly at least usually drunk, and he stinks to high heaven. In an era when baths and showers and that sort of thing were not common to begin with, Luther Martin seems to be a throwback. He doesn't do it at all, is the general presumption, and he just stinks to high heaven, and nobody wants to be locked in a room with this guy. And so he actually doesn't get on any committees. Madison is overlooked for many of the committees, simply because they don't, they're really starting to reject his views on things with this strong national government and doing away with states and the likes of that. It's been said of the Philadelphia Convention, and one of the best books out there on the convention is called The Miracle at Philadelphia. And we often take it for granted in some ways. Because we don't know what went on at the convention, when we don't, as a collective group, we don't know. We don't study it. We don't talk about it. And so we don't really understand. To us, 4.5 months to hammer out the government that we have today seems miraculous because, my gosh, they got that done in a hurry, didn't they? These men were expecting to have this done in less than a month. They are on edge at the way that this is just dragging on and on in their view. The miracle at Philadelphia isn't just that they came up with the Constitution of the United States, which is in and of itself an amazing document, the first of its type in the history of mankind, the first real experiment with whether or not men can rule themselves by law. It's, as Madison will describe it, that's miracle enough in and of itself when you understand what was good. The real miracle is that they were able to get anything done at all and that nobody ended up challenging anybody else to a duel, let alone beating the crap out of each other. Remember, at one point, James Madison will actually insult the entire state of Connecticut when he questions their patriotism and their service in the Revolutionary War. Others will refer to each other. I mean, they dig at each other. People today say, oh, politics has never been more mean. They say today we've never been more divided. Anybody that says that has never cracked a book about the convention in Philadelphia in 1787. Because not only were we divided, Rufus King is about to point out the fact that John Rutledge has really divided us with his first draft. In fact, his first draft might as well be called the Confederacy of Southern States Constitution. It really might as well be called that. And we're insulting each other like crazy. And through it all, of course, George Washington just sits there silently, fuming, because he wants to get this done and he wants to get this over with. And he has his own views, but he knows that the process has to go through. And so all these committees form, and they start meeting with these committees, and they start working on the little subsections. But they still debate in the main room. And it's this debate that really sets the stage for moving forward as much as the committees do. And yet at the same time, and I can't overemphasize this enough, we look at it today with 220 some odd years of hindsight. We know how this is going to end, and so we expect certain things to happen. On August 13th, 1787, there was no such expectation. In fact, most people there believed that, number one, they weren't going to succeed, and number two, as Nathaniel Gorham will say, even if we do succeed, this government won't last for 100 years. 150 at the outside most is how long this will last. That's it. So in the broader sense, you know, really, why are we bothering? I mean, we can put all the rules you want here, but it's not going to matter because it's not going to work, is the attitude of many of the people there. There was no expectation that they would succeed amongst at least half of the delegates. Those that thought that they would succeed really wanted their own vision enforced, whether that vision was a completely nationalistic government with state governments relegated to virtually nothing more than counties, or whether they wanted what Rutledge is going to propose in his draft. And we're going to talk, like I said, we're going to talk about this in just a second. Rutledge's draft is, well, when Rufus King of Massachusetts reads this draft, and Rufus King has been quiet throughout most of the sessions. He's one of the few people that attends every session. And he is the son of a loyalist, by the way. He's the son of a loyalist, but he himself is a patriot. There's some reasons why his father became a loyalist. His father was probably more patriot than loyalist, but he became a loyalist when the rebels ransacked his home and scared the crap out of his family. And he wasn't happy about that. John Adams even wrote about that later on, about the fact that many of the rebels did harm to the cause by their overzealousness in attacking people who otherwise might have supported them. Didn't seem to affect Rufus. He became a patriot anyway, and he will actually go on to become a very prominent American who, again, we've long forgotten and most people don't know about. But as the convention meets on the third day after the draft has been presented to them, there's some concerns. And Rufus King is about to make a challenge. And when he gets done with that challenge, Gouverneur Morris is going to follow that up with one of the most passionate speeches ever given on American soil. One might even call it the first anti-slavery speech ever given. And then the committee and the convention will have to decide. Where do we go from here? It's Constitution Thursday. It's Plausibly Live, the official podcast of the Dave Bowman Show.
Today's media. Print.
Print is dead.
TV.
TV's still sort of there.
Internet.
Internet is there.
All those sources come in our next podcast regarding today's media and how it's changed with social media.
And how it may change in the future.
So listen to us on Lawless Chat from the Podcast 99 Network.
They still haven't built a circuit that could hold him. The Eric Wallace Podcast.
This is The Scotsman.
And this is Drew.
And we are the Ale Evangelist Show, spreading the good news of good booze across the land.
Wine is nice, but beer is better.
It is indeed. So tune in to us on the Podcast 99 Network, where California comes to talk, www.podcast99.com. Doctor,
doctor. Hi there. I'm Christine Papworth.
And I'm Wendy Papworth Bates.
And we're your real estate doctors. Listen to House Calls with the Real Estate Doctors on therealestatedoctors.net and podcast99.com.
Hi, this is Pat from Lawless Chat. Are you a small business person looking for that perfect location in Modesto? Having the perfect space is a key to growing and being successful. 2020 Standiford has good access to Highway 99 and all of Modesto. It's the perfect location for reaching the city of Modesto and all of the great Central Valley. Mike Royer, property manager, wants to show you a spectacular 1,482 square foot office location on Standiford Avenue that's available now. It's the perfect location for developing a dynamic business here in the Central Valley. Want to know more? Call Mike today at 996-6396. That's 996-6396. Tell him Pat from Lawless Chat sent you.
for the powdered wigs and knickers inside all of us.
You're listening to Constitution Thursday.
The convention begins by looking at a section. At the time, it's Article 4, Section 4. And it reads as follows. As the proportions of numbers in different states will alter from time to time, the legislature shall, in each of these cases, regulate the number of representatives by the number of inhabitants according to the provisions herein after made, at the rate of 1 for every 40,000. This sort of catches the attention of some folks. It creates some concern when further William's son of North Carolina, who is, you know, representing a slave state, a tobacco state, a farming state, a southern state, as it were, brings up the point that he wants to strike out the part where it says, according to the provisions herein after made. And he wants to replace that with, according to the rule hereafter to be provided for direct taxation. So in other words, in Article 7, as it stands right now, Section 3 later on, it provides that the states would be subject to direct taxation on the basis of the whole number of white and other free citizens and inhabitants, and 3/5 of all other persons not comprehended in the foregoing description, which is a weird way of saying slaves. This question is agreed to. Okay, well, you're right. We should change that. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia say yes. New Jersey, Delaware say no. We don't like that. But it's at this point that Rufus King of Massachusetts, who has, as I said, attended every session of this convention so far, and King is noted for having supported the 3/5 compromise, the original 3/5 compromise. But now he is just about to blow his stack. And he wants to question this whole thing. He's got some problems with this. If you take the draft as a whole, and obviously we don't have time to read the entirety of the draft, you can find it on the internet if you'd like. But if you read the initial draft that Rutledge has come up with, it includes very curious things. Now, King, Rufus King of Massachusetts, is very pro-national government. He, like Madison, believes that the national government should be very, very strong, and that the states should be united in their purpose and their goal. And he also sees that the great point of this entire proceeding is twofold. What are the great objects of the general system, he says? Number one, defense against foreign invasion. Number two, defense against internal sedition. As far as he sees it, those are the real reasons why we need a new, strong national government. And taken as a whole, this is going to be the primary argument later on of the Federalists, as they argue in favor of the Constitution, that this gives the nation the best defense against foreign invasion and the best defense against internal sedition. Rufus King has pointed this out again, but he begins to pick apart the draft because he's noted several things in here. And there's a lot more than what I'm going to talk about here, but there's three things that really grind his gears. Number one, this 40,000 thing just doesn't sit well with him because the first draft of the Constitution, as prepared by Rutledge, John Rutledge of South Carolina, also provides that there is never to be any limitation on the importation of slaves. Now, they've just changed the verbiage to the same as the direct taxation, meaning that the 3/5 compromise is now in play for representation. Of course, it always was, or would have been anyway, but now it's definitive. And you combine that with the idea that there's no limits whatsoever on the South bringing in more slaves. Do you see the problem already? So in the North, you've got to convince people to come to the North. You've got to convince people to come to New England, Connecticut, in the dead of winter time, where I've been. Let me tell you, it's beautiful, but it's cold. You've got to convince people to come to New York. You've got to convince people to come to Massachusetts. You've got to convince people to come to these places. Or you have to make new people, which, of course, as you know, take some effort, a little bit of effort anyway, and take some time. And there aren't that many the population isn't that big that it can really grow as fast as it can if you happen to be in the South, where you just get on a ship, you sail over to West Africa, you buy some slaves, you bring in over a whole shipload, and you just keep bringing them in. And then again, you know, you're talking about slaves, so you've got a breeding process that's going on here. I don't know what else to call it. That's what they did. It sounds disgusting, and it is disgusting, but it was what was happening. And all of a sudden, you have a formula here for the South to essentially overwhelm at 1 to every 40,000, counting 3/5 of slaves, to overwhelm the national legislature. And Rufus King looks at this and just shakes his head because, you know, Puritan Massachusetts, they're abolitionist. This is not good. And his intimation is, look, you can have one or the other. You can have the 3/5, which he supported because he wants a strong national government, or you can have the no limits on the importation of slaves. You can't have both. Sorry, we're not going to go with that. But he's also upset and makes the point of pointing out that the Rutledge deal has, not only do they have no limitations on the importation of slaves, but they also, in the first draft of the Constitution, tie the government's hands in that there are no export taxes. In other words, you can't tax anything that goes out. That's this whole direct taxes versus import-export taxes and sort of things like that. That's why they want direct taxes, and that's why they want to tie this to direct taxes and not to export taxes. Because the Southern economy is built entirely on exports. Tobacco, cotton, whatever else they grow down there at that point. And who is it that's doing all that labor? It's the slaves. More slaves, more tobacco, more cotton, more exports, more money for the South. These three things taken together just cause Rufus King to just blow his stack. He's furious. And then he really gets going and he talks about the fact that, look, the two great objects here are defense against foreign invasions and defense against internal sedition. Well, you're going to ask all these other states to defend Southern interests with none of the benefits of doing this. You're going to take over. You're going to take over the national legislature. You're going to decide what foreign threats there are or what internal threats there are. And then you're going to require, because it's a union, you're going to require all these other states, including Massachusetts, which is anti-slavery, to come down here and defend your way of life. And we are not going to do that. We are not going to approve this Constitution the way it stands right now. We're just not going to do it. Sorry, you're out of luck. He further points out, and this, again, today to us, we don't get it. But think about in 1787 what he was saying. Shall one part of the United States be bound to defend another part, and that other part be at liberty not only to increase its own danger, but to withhold compensation for the burden? If slaves are to be imported, shall not the exports produced by their labor supply a revenue the better able to the general government to defend their masters? In other words, shouldn't you be paying for this defense that you want to have to do this? Not only that, he goes out of his way to point out internal sedition is one of the fears we have. And what is the thing that scares the South more than anything on this planet? It isn't Britain. It isn't Spain. It isn't France. It's an internal slave revolt. And he points his finger right at that and he says, you want us to come down there and defend you from something you caused? You imported more and more slaves, more to the point where the population imbalance is there. And all of a sudden the slaves, they decide, as slaves often do, hey, we've had enough of this. You want us to come down here and defend you when you haven't paid a dime for that defense and you created the problem? Absolutely not, he says. Indeed, he could so little persuade himself of the rectitude of such a practice that he was not sure he could assent to it under any circumstances. At all other events, he said, either slaves should not be represented, or exports should be taxable. He's not willing to go all the way. He's not willing to say the word abolition. abolition, sorry. He's not willing to push that far. In fact, he's okay with the three-fifths compromise as long as it results in a strong national government. But when combined with what Rutledge has come up with here, this idea that we're just going to import slaves and import slaves and import slaves and import slaves, and by the way, you can't tax their labor. You can't, you know, no, we're not going to participate in paying to the national government, and we're going to do this direct tax thing, which is going to keep our taxes lower than yours proportionally. You see what the problem is? He draws the line in the sand. Sherman of Connecticut says the slave trade is iniquitous, sinful. But we've already settled this point of representation after deliberation and discussion. Can we really go back and do this again? Madison, because he's still Madison, objects to 1 to every 40,000 inhabitants as a perpetual rule. The future increase in population, if the Union should be permanent, he said, will render that number of representatives excessive. As we've already pointed out, in today's world, it would be almost 12,000 representatives. Nathaniel Gorham then points out somewhat, I don't know, snarkily, that the government won't last that long anyway. This vast country, including its western territory, won't be a nation 150 years from now. It can't work. Ellsworth points out that, hey, there's a section in here about amendments, and if the government does go that long, well, they can amend it. And after all this discussion, and after all of King's passion and his rage against this, and yet he leaves the door open. Look, you can have one or you can have the other, but you can't have both. Sorry. No, we will never agree to that. After all of this, Sherman and Madison move to insert the words not exceeding before the words 1 for every 40,000, which was agreed to. Okay, yeah, that we can agree to. And you think at that point that it's over. But one of the most interesting characters in all of our history, and a guy that we met some years ago on Constitution Thursday, and you know, even John, when he was a part of that, when we did a top five later on about top five people you would invite to your dinner party, put this guy on his list because he's become one of those people that every American should know. There should be hundreds and thousands of children in America named Gouverneur. Because of this man. But the problem is his personal life was such a wreck that people tend to ignore what he did outside of that. Gouverneur Morris has had it. He's furious. And this whole discussion and all the words of Rufus King have moved him in a way almost never seen in that era and rarely seen in American history. And he stands up and he is about to do something that has never been done before. He is going to call slavery what it really is. And he's going to point fingers and he is going to lay blame and he is going to rail against the evils of slavery. It will be the first real anti-slavery speech ever given in America. And it's going to be done over this 40,000 thing. I've said this before, and I've written about it before, and I will bring it up again. And one of the things that frustrates me the most about our world today and our national understanding of the Constitution are people who say things like, the Constitution was written for white misogynist slaveholders. In fact, let me give you a direct quote from a Facebook post that someone tagged me in once upon a time. Quote, time for a brief American history lesson. Our government was set up by privileged landowners. Many of them were also slave owners. When they said all men are created equal, they were not thinking about anyone other than people like themselves, unquote. Well, of course, anybody that's taken the time to listen to this convention section of Constitution Thursday or read the notes knows that that is not only untrue, it's dangerously, wildly inaccurate and paints a picture that we suppose we want to have, but at the same time takes away from what was actually accomplished. When Rutledge completed his first draft, as I've mentioned, his first draft might as well have been called the Constitution of the Confederacy of the United States and Southern United States, and passed in 1861. It might as well have been called that. Everything in it favored the South, benefited the South, benefited the slaves, and by the South I mean the slave states, benefited the iniquitous practice of slavery. Rufus King's comments are, look, you can have one of the two. You can have, you know, your three-fifths compromise, or you can have, you know, no export of taxes, or you can have no limits on slavery. You can't have all of that. I'm sorry. You're taking advantage of everyone else, as Washington wrote in his letters about the demagogues usurping the Constitution and trying to take over the government. The North was willing to compromise. The anti-slavery people were willing to compromise, but they weren't willing to just give away the entire store. And again, because we know how this ends, we know that eventually there will be limits on the importation of slaves, because even the South recognizes the fact that, crap, we're not going to be able to get away with that. Gouverneur Morris, however, rises after all of this, and he moves to insert the word free before inhabitants, because if you start counting slaves, essentially what you're asking us to do is uphold domestic slavery, and we're not going to do that. It's nefarious. I love that word. He went on. It's the curse of heaven on the states where a rich and noble cultivation marks the prosperity and happiness of the people with the misery and poverty which overspread the barren wastes of Virginia, Maryland, and the other states having slaves. He talks about traveling through all of the states, and he talks about the difference that you feel. He talks about how in the slave states, it's a veritable desert of culture and happiness. How everything is just miserable. Everything is work, 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 work all the time. And the country looks terrible and the buildings are ramshackle. And it's a pit of poverty and unhappiness. And then he talks about how as soon as you cross into the free states, Pennsylvania, New York, New Jersey's, every criterion of superior improvement witnesses the change, he says. Can you imagine saying that? Upon what principle is it that slaves shall be computed in the representation? Are they men? Then make them citizens and let them vote, he says. Are they property? Why then is no other property included? The houses in this city of Philadelphia are worth more than all the wretched slaves which cover the rice swamps of South Carolina. The admission to slaves into Georgia and South Carolina, the admissions of slaves into the representation, when fairly explained, comes to this, that the inhabitants of Georgia and South Carolina, who goes to the coast of Africa and in defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity, tears away his fellow creatures from their dearest connections and damns them to the most cruel bondages, shall have more votes in a government instituted for the protection of the rights of mankind than the citizen of Pennsylvania or New Jersey who views with a laudable horror so nefarious a practice. Are those the words of someone who's setting up a government to support slavery? He went on to add that domestic slavery is the most prominent feature in the aristocratic countenance of the proposed Constitution, the first draft. The vassalage of the poor has ever been the favorite offspring of the aristocracy. Are those the words of a man who's setting up a constitution for the rich? What is the proposed compensation to the northern states for the sacrifice of every principle of right, every impulse of humanity? They are to bind themselves to march their militia for the defense of the southern states, for the defense against those very slaves of whom they complain. The North must supply vessels and seamen in case of foreign attack. The legislature will have indefinite power to tax them by excises and duties on their imports, both of which will fall heavier on them than on the southern inhabitants. For the bohea tea used by the northern freeman will pay more tax than the whole consumption of the miserable slave. which consists of nothing more than his physical substance and the rag which covers his nakedness. On the other side, the southern states will not be restrained from importing fresh supplies of wretched Africans at once to increase the danger of attack and the difficulty of defense. Nay, they are to be encouraged to it by an assurance of having their votes in the national government increased by proportion, and at the same time to have their exports and their slaves exempt from all future contributions to public service. Let it not be said that direct taxation is to be proportioned to representation. It is idle to suppose that the general government can stretch its hands directly into the pockets of the people scattered over so vast a country. They can only do it through the medium of exports, imports, and excises. For what then are all these sacrifices to be made? I would sooner submit myself to a tax for paying for all the Negroes in the United States than to saddle posterity with such a constitution as you have proposed here. Mr. Dayton, in the silence that follows, stands and seconds the motion. He did it, he said, that his sentiments on the subject might appear. Hear, hear. Whatever the fate of the amendment, I want it on record that I support what he said. Mr. Wilson thinks the motion is premature. An agreement to the clause would bar no objection to it. On the motion to insert free before inhabitants, New Jersey, aye, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, no. It is a mistake to believe that all of the framers were out to just increase slavery. It's also a mistake to believe that they weren't willing to compromise to the ultimate defeat of slavery. But they understood that without union, that was never going to happen, ever. After the Civil War ended, numerous Confederate folks, especially wealthier folks, moved to the nation of Brazil in South America. Do you know why? Because slavery was still legal there. Well into the 1880s, almost 1890s. There were so many ideas put forth here that resulted in arguments, debates, passionate insults, that it's hard to believe that they actually got this done. Breaking into those committees might have been the smartest thing ever. Because their committees are going to shape everything back into things, and they're going to deal with the objections that have been made to this essentially Southern Constitution. And eventually there will be limits on the importations of slaves. And as for that 40,000 thing, well, Washington will actually push during the first Congress for an amendment to the Constitution as part of the proposed Bill of Rights, to limit it to one to every 30,000. That amendment did not pass. It's still out there. It could theoretically still pass, and that's what the 30,000.org people are trying to do. I think it would be unwieldy, but like I said, it is still out there. It is still an idea. And the ideas of abolition eventually would come to the forefront, and eventually the idea of slavery would be defeated once and for all. But it was only defeated because of union. Without that, it never would have happened.
Constitution Thursday is a feature segment on Plausibly Live, the official podcast of The Dave Bowman Show, a Slippery Fish Entertainment production for the Podcast 99 Network. Copyright MMXV. All rights reserved. For more information, log on to ConstitutionThursday.com.